Hello again, everyone, and welcome to Down with the 90s. This is your look at the times when the clothes were bright, the stars were brighter, and yes, they may well have been some of the best times of our lives, the 90s. We are here. We are talking about it. My name is Jerry Strauss, and folks, we've got someone who played a very special part in the hearts of many of our lives during that time in a couple of pretty major ways. So we'd like to welcome to the lines as our guest this week, the one and only Christine Elise. How are you?
I am very well. How are you?
I'm doing great. Thank you for joining
you.
Us.
No problem.
All right. So let's get right to it because we want to bring people up to speed and remind them of exactly what great things you've done, what you're doing now. Let's go back to the beginning. Now, you were, we'd exchanged some emails last week. You're actually a native of Boston. Is that correct?
That is correct.
Okay. So clearly a lot of New England pride that you've taken with you all this time later. At what point did you leave that area?
I left Boston when I was 19. I moved to L.A. by myself.
Oh, okay. But still, I'm not sure if Jerseyans have a great deal of pride in our own state, but certainly, you know, people from New York and different cities like that, you know, that's a huge part of their identity no matter where they go in their lives. Is that the same thing for you find for a lot of people who grew up in Boston?
That is absolutely true for your average Bostonian. It's not true for me. I do not have that level of my identity is not wrapped into being Bostonian. That might be largely in part because I'm not a sports fan at all. So, you know, I don't really care which team of millionaires beats the other team of millionaires, and I don't understand why anybody else cares either. And so much of Boston pride is Red Sox, Bruins, Celtics, and the Boston-New York rivalry is obviously a baseball thing, and none of that interests me and never has. So I don't have that. And I left Boston so early, too, that I don't – I love Boston. I'm glad I grew up there. I can't imagine ever living there again, though. So I'm sort of a black sheep from Boston.
Did you have the accent?
Oh, my God. I had it so bad you couldn't understand me. I was 84, though, when I moved here. So, excuse me, I'm sick, so pardon me if I sneeze and cough. I had it so bad that people would literally be unable to understand me. And I lost it even before I wanted to be an actor, just so that I could be understood.
Did you do that naturally, or were you, like, practicing every day in front of a mirror how to pronounce
things? To lose it?
Yeah.
No, you just lose it. It just goes away when people, especially when people make fun of you and they realize what you are saying and tease you because you're saying it so ridiculously. Boston accents are so, they're really dramatic. They're really, they're not,
did you
it's
do
not
the
a pretty
wicked
accent
thing,
either.
You,
huh?
Did you do the wicked thing, calling everything wicked good?
Of course.
And wicked, really? Everyone
of course.
Does that there, huh?
Of course they did, yeah.
That's crazy.
Yeah, and that's the era, too, so... Wicked was a wicked pissa. But yeah, so I definitely had it. I got rid of it just because it was facilitated being understood. And then as an actor, whatever was left of it, I had to get rid of just to succeed as an actor.
Gotcha.
It just goes away. It's sort of second nature. For a long time, I could just drop back into the accent by just not trying to not have it. Now I have to make an effort to do it. Now it's as foreign to me as almost as foreign to me as not doing it was initially, you know.
Congratulations, I guess.
Yeah, it's quite a feat. I'm pretty proud.
So you moved out to LA at 19. So where did the acting come in your life? At what point did you decide that you were going to pursue that?
I had decided I wanted to be involved in filmmaking when I was still in Boston. I went to Boston University for a year. I was in their it was called the School of Communications back then, I forget what it was called. So gosh, a long time ago. Anyway, I was in their their school of public communications. So, yeah, that's PC, and you know, it's called whatever. It doesn't matter. So, anyway, I did a year there, and I thought, hey, this makes no sense. I'm going to spend 4 years doing getting a degree in a field that there's no industry in Boston to support. Wouldn't it make more sense to move to Los Angeles, establish residency in California, go to a state school, because back then, like, UCLA cost $600 a year if you were a California resident, until Reaganomics ended that. So that was my plan, just to move here, establish residency, and go to UCLA or and do film school here, and then do internships and learn my way around. And so I didn't get out of school and then, you know, fall off the turnip truck from Boston with a degree and no experience. So that was my plan. It didn't work out. Once I got a job on Rodeo Drive as a cashier, you know, making, I think, $6 an hour, which was almost double minimum wage at the time, so I felt like I was rich, but still, it's not a lot to live on. And I had to work 60 hours a week or so just to make ends meet, and I couldn't afford school, and I couldn't afford time off from work, even if school were free. And so 2.5 years later, I'm like, oh, my God, I'm going to be a cashier the rest of my life. This is so not what I saw for myself. And I started to try to figure out another way I could get into filmmaking that didn't require any training or skills or talent. And I thought, hey, I know, I'll be an actress. people who can't act make a living all the time. Why can't I be one of them? And so I endeavored to do that. And I, at that point, I was in my early 20s. I still looked incredibly baby-faced and looked 15. And because I looked so young but wasn't, and I was also, my high school years are extremely big punk rock past for me, and that there's always a residual element of that and how I look, even somewhat to this day. And so I made a very interesting and very young looking actress, and because I looked 15 and I was offbeat, I started working right away. And then I realized I liked it. Acting was never, I was always too shy, and it was never anything I aspired to. But I liked it, and then I was like, hey, and now I don't even want to direct anymore. This being an actor thing is, it's nice work if you can get it, so I'm going to stay here.
Wow.
And that's that.
You got it right away. That's pretty cool. And just to go back to something you said before about being able to act if you don't have any talent and et cetera, et cetera. Do you still believe that to an extent, or have you gained sort of a...
That I can't act?
No. Just in general, that sort of the field of acting is wide open for people who don't have any sort of talent, or have you changed your view?
That's true of anything that's creative, because it's so subjective. Mm-hmm. So that's true of books, movies, paintings, you know, sculpture, whatever, poetry, certainly of poetry. I mean, what is talent really? It's just a matter of opinion. Talent, even, like, some people can be talented and still not appealing. I'm not a big Tom Cruise fan. I think he's obviously a talented actor. I just don't care. You know, you'll see people on The Voice, for example, or on, you know, American Idol, and technically they can sing. But
right. You'd
be okay if you never heard them sing again. It's just because they're not interesting. So, I think that people get away with it all the time. And people who are talented, you know, sometimes suck. And people who suck sometimes fall into the right role, the right moment, and win Academy Awards. So, you know, I don't lose sleep over it. I just try and make my way.
You sound like someone who's been out on the West Coast for a really long time.
I have.
Kind of jaded, but that's okay because...
That's not jaded. That's actually positive. I don't think that's jaded at all. I think that it is so subjective, and I think all creative endeavors are, it's a really competitive. Everybody would like to get paid to do what they love, and some people are lucky enough to get to do it, and some are not, and then there's shifts and cycles for everybody too. So it's not jaded, actually. I don't think of it as jaded. I don't feel negative about it at all. It's just the reality of it, you know, and I'm cool with that.
Hey, fair enough. So you went out to L.A., started working right away. What were you doing when you first got out there? Was there, like, commercials or what types of auditions?
No, 2.5 years. I was a cashier on Rodeo Drive, and I didn't have a driver's license either. So I was living in Los Angeles, taking the bus everywhere for 2 years. which was unbelievable. That is something that you should do a documentary on. This is not a town that you don't want to have a car in. And making $6 an hour. So anyway, when I decided to become an actress and started working, I was TV right away, which is really interesting because television shows, because I was considered really edgy, and everyone told me in the beginning, oh, you're going to work in films, which is what I wanted. Films were, that was my whole goal to begin with. I didn't want to be famous. I didn't want to be an actress. I wanted to be involved in filmmaking, specifically filmmaking, not even television. And so everyone saying, you're so edgy, you're definitely going to have a big career in film, was just, that's ears, music to my ears. And then I proceeded to have a very mainstream television career, which perplexed and frustrated me for a really long time. I only did one commercial in my whole life. I've tried to get hundreds of them. They just don't like me. I think, again, because of the edginess that I can't seem to suppress. And so commercials have never been my thing. But there always seemed to be room for the character that I played 1,000 times, which is the offbeat, misunderstood, tough chick with a heart of gold.
I got to ask, what was the commercial?
It was for Clearasil. And the interesting thing, it was like in 1988 or 89. It was an early job for me, 89 probably. And there were four actors in it that were running. The camera was a zit monster, and we were all like trying to run away from the zit monster to maintain our dewy teenage skin. And I ran into somebody else who was in the commercial with me a couple of years ago, and she's like, can you believe the cast of that commercial? Like, and I was like, Vivica Fox was one of the people in the commercial with me, completely unknown at the time. I was had never really worked at the time. And she's like, can you believe Mark? Mark's just blown up. Like, Mark who? Mark Ruffalo. So Mark Ruffalo and Vivica Fox and myself were three of the four actors in that commercial. I would love to see that commercial now. I so wish I'd taped it.
Oh, man. Anybody out there, search YouTube. You got to send that to one of us. We're going to find this thing.
Seriously. And the funny thing is, the fourth person, Mitzi Martin is her name, she was a model, and a beautiful model. She and her sister were like these sort of Nordic, white-skinned, ice green, ice blue, super light-eyed girls. And her sister was platinum-haired, and she dyed her hair black. And Mitzi Martin was, at the time, in the 80s, was a bit of a club kid in Los Angeles, and I was involved in that scene, too, a bit. And so when I did that commercial, I was completely starstruck by Mitzi Martin. I'm like, oh, my God, it's Mitzi Martin. Oh, my God, it's Mitzi Martin. And, in fact, the other two people end up become huge movie stars.
Wow. That's something that needs to be unearthed, that commercial, for a variety
yeah.
of reasons.
You got to Google Mitzi Martin. I just did to make sure I got her name right. And she's just astonishingly beautiful person. So that's the commercial.
Cool. So you were doing that, but then, as you said, you moved on to doing a lot of TV that you felt conflicted about. Was your first thing that you were doing on a regular basis China Beach?
The first recurring thing I got was China Beach, yeah.
Okay. And how did you feel?
Which is my favorite job to date.
Yeah, I saw a note that you've said that in prior interviews. So was that, how did you see that as opposed to some of the things that you maybe did later and felt maybe a little more conflicted about?
Well, first of all, let me clarify the confliction, the conflict. It was just, all work is fun, all sets are fun, you know, but some shows are written better than others, and some shows give you something to do that you can really sink your teeth into, and some don't. You know, for some shows, it's not even their job. Their job is to be fluffy and light, and you know,
sure.
That's not my sensibility. My sensibility tends to be darker. Even when it's funny, I tend to go dark. So, and TV, just especially in the 80s, you know, wasn't famous for being dark, except for Twin Peaks, and so, which I worshipped and would have killed to be on. But anyway, China Beach was great because it was the first, recurring thing I got to do, so I got to go back and play the character more than one time. Actually, it's not true. The first recurring I got was Head of the Class. I did a recurring thing on Head of the Class.
Really? Undocumented. Did not see that anywhere. What did you do on Head of the Class? I used to love that.
I played Rhonda Feelgood Gielgud, the town pump.
The town pump. That was the nickname, Feel Good?
Rhonda Feel Good Gielgud. Rhonda Gielgud. She's Feel Good Gielgud because she was a sure thing.
And you,
she, of course, was also misunderstood, though.
Oh,
and it was
horrible.
Redeemed later.
Everyone on that show was.
Yeah. Right.
Greatest educational system ever in head of the class.
Yeah.
Everyone was fixed. But, well,
yeah,
that's pretty cool. How much did you
I probably did three or four of them. I didn't do many. And I didn't do many China Beaches. I did probably three or four of those as well. But the China Beach show, now that was great for me for a couple of reasons. One, the material was just sort of the finest television writing that's ever happened. So that material is astounding. They gave me really great stuff to do. It was very difficult. Every day I go to set afraid I couldn't pull off what they wanted from me, and somehow I'd go home and feel like I had, which was really sort of life-affirming for me. I was a brand-new actor, and I felt like I was doing work that I was proud of, which was a nice feeling for anybody. And the cast was older. The cast ahead of the class was very young, and not all that of that cast was particularly friendly. So it was a kind of a mixed bag of hostility and friendliness on that set, which was not the case on China Beach. China Beach, the cast was outrageously talented, for the most part, adult. Mm-hmm. And really, really supportive. I'm friends with people from that show to this day. I hiked the Hollywood sign today with Megan Gallagher, who was a regular on that show for a while. So, and Robert Picardo is a good friend still, too. So that was great. That was a great, great, great experience. And then the gift that it gave in the future was because I had done that with John Wells. That's how I ended up being cast on ER. So it was a gift that kept giving.
And that's sort of how it works, huh? Connections,
yeah.
Connections.
Mm-hmm.
So in ER, you were on for about 17
seasons.
Episodes,
one
I
season.
Should say. One
yeah,
season,
one whole
17?
Season. Yeah.
Well, that's,
17
okay.
of the 22 they shot, yeah.
And you mentioned that was the gift that kept on giving. That also, you know, obviously known to be a very, you know, well-written, critically acclaimed show, especially in the early days.
Yeah.
Is that another sort of China Beach-esque source of pride for you when you look back on that
body
of
work? Of course. It's the same. And the cast often overlapped. Guests and stuff were all China Beach people. And the crew, and John Wells did both shows, and the crew was, you know, half the crew was from China Beach, so it was like walking into family, and again, some of the best writing in television, and they'd give me things to do that were challenging and felt authentic. And it was at Warner Brothers, which is my favorite lot, and it's really close to my house, too, which is even cuter, and it was just great. And George was there, and the show, season two of the show. Both 90210 and ER, I came in on season two, so the shows were in the full swing of their, like, you know, their phenomenon status was at its peak. And so they were both fun shows to be involved with when they were at their absolutely most popular, you know.
That's awesome. Yeah. Interesting parallel to very different shows we're talking about.
Yeah.
Before I get to 90210, I also want to mention what I'd imagine was, if not your feature film debut, certainly your most prominent role on a film to date at that point back in 1990, you were privileged enough to be a part of a little film called Child's Play 2. Which was a very popular deal. I mean, not to knock it at all. Certainly those movies, they lasted for a reason because there was a certain dark comic sensibility to it. How did you enjoy that experience?
I was completely in love with every minute of that experience. It was my first big job. It lasted long enough that it, like, and I was so poor at the time, it just really, like, sort of changed my life. TV shows shoot for, you know, you're on a set for maybe 5 days and then you're gone. This was a couple of months of working almost every day, which was like winning the lottery for me just to be, and I would go to work. I'd go to on the set on days I didn't have to even go or stay long after they'd wrapped me and I was free to go home and I would just stay the whole day anyway. And it's funny because I program several actually, but the one I've been doing for 15 years is one in Michigan called Waterfront Film Festival, which just happened the weekend of June 12th, just a couple weeks ago. And we did a flashback screening of a couple of different movies. We did Pee-wee's Big Adventure, we did Cool as Ice, and we did Child's Play 2. Mm-hmm. And I sat through Child's Play 2 for the first time since 1990 and saw it all the way through again for the first time since it was released. And I enjoyed it. I enjoyed it a lot. I was amazed. I thought, oh, God, it's going to feel really slow and take forever. And it was paced really well. I found it funnier now than I used to, and I had a great time. It's a great little horror movie.
Yeah. What is it like to make a movie? It's an interesting thing because on one hand you think it's a horror movie, so it requires a certain amount of dramatic, maybe over-dramatic intensity to sort of sell that aspect of it. At the same time, the Child's Play movies had an element of comedy to them, so was it sort of a light set? Was it a fun set, or was it more of an edgy...
No, it's a fun set. You have a little kid on it. You've got a 7-year-old on the set, so he's the primary asset. You've got a little baby, you know, mm-hmm. 7-year-old Alex Vincent running around. you have to respect that. And most sets are light. I've never been on a dark set. I've been on the only time they're dark is if you've got a really particularly cranky director or cranky first AD and they keep the set tense because they yell at everybody. But beyond that, sets are always great. There's so many people on them that if there's always someone you can, you know, go to for companionship. You know what I mean? It's a giant community of people. So if you have a bad time on any set, unless you're being genuinely harassed by somebody, if you're having a bad time on a set, it's your own fault. Because you can always go to the next person, you know? But the interesting thing about Child's Play for me was that we did have a 7-year-old who was the lead, and he had child labor laws applied to his, you know, his shift every day. And then the puppet, Chucky takes, at the time, so I'm sure it's different now, but the technology then was that it took 7 puppeteers to work him, all of them with, like, cables and remotes, and one guy would work his left hand and one with the right hand, and somebody do his eyes, and blah, blah, blah. And those 7 puppeteers were all union, SAG, my actor union, they were all union members. So they were more expensive. That doll cost Universal every day way more than I cost them. So what would happen is we'd do a scene, and they would shoot Alex out first because he had to be out and also do his certain amount of tutoring, et cetera. That's all the law. And they would wrap him when he had to be. And then they would shoot all the doll stuff because doll was really expensive. He was 7 times as expensive as me. And they would wrap the doll. And then I'd be there and have to do the same scene, a scene with Chucky and Alex, and neither of them were on the set. And so I would be doing a scene almost the entire movie. Anytime you don't see the person actually on camera in the same frame with me, they probably weren't there when I was saying the dialogue. And so I'm doing it all to, like, this red tape on this stand over here, that's Chucky. And this blue tape over here, that's Andy. And so talk about heightened drama and pretending to make something seem real. I'm completely fabricating in my imagination everything that's happening around me.
Yeah, it's interesting because, you know, in today's landscape, that's probably more common than ever because of CGI and stuff, but this was sort of a precursor to that. So you were kind of ahead of your time in that situation.
Yeah, but, now I've got some experience.
yeah, there you go. So you did that, and of course, meanwhile you're doing your TV. A lot of the TV stuff came after this. Is that correct?
Yeah.
Okay, so you move into doing some TV stuff, and in the middle of that comes the reason that I knew of you, which, of course, is your stint on 90210, the original, obviously, of course, that was your character of Emily Valentine. And it's funny because sometimes I just sort of judge the influence of different characters and different personalities from long ago just on how well I happen to remember them. And I watched 90210. I wasn't, like, a diehard or anything, but I watched most of the early seasons or whatever, and I don't remember a lot of what happened, but for some reason, your character, I think because of just how different you were compared to just, you know, all the other characters when you showed up, very, very vivid memory of that. Was that the intent, to bring somebody in to sort of contrast everybody and sort of shake things up?
Yes.
That was, that was the gimmick, huh?
Yeah.
And you were the one for the job, clearly. You had already, at this point, you had mentioned you've played similar characters in different shows and such. So at this point, was it established that this was sort of your thing?
No, I don't, I was really poor. I had really short, I kept my hair really short, most of the time, because if I had longer hair, hairdressers and stuff would, like, do the most heartbreaking stuff to it. So, and I did a matlock one time, and I looked like Delta Burke. I had this giant bouffant hairdo. So I just learned to keep my hair short, so there was limited things people could do to my hair to make me look stupid. And I was a blonde, but I couldn't afford to keep up my blondness, and so I often had those roots that I had on the show. I've had them on ER, too. I had them on ER. And because basically an audition comes, they go, you're going in tomorrow at 2, and I didn't have time to get to deal with it beforehand. So I had already played that character, not that character, but teenagers that were either troubled or just sort of a little offbeat already, because that's what I looked like. I know the character for on 90210, she was initially, when I read for her, she was described as being drop-dead gorgeous with waist-length curly red hair, and could, like Julia Roberts is what I'm envisioning when I read that breakdown, and the kind of, you know, the kind of beauty that stops traffic, which no one's ever accused me of being, and I didn't have waist-length red hair, and I couldn't ride a motorcycle, and I couldn't sing, and I couldn't play guitar, all things they needed this character to do. And I went in anyway, and they changed the character to suit what I was. And same thing actually happened on ER. They actually, the prototype for that was Helen Hunt from Mad About You, which I didn't know when I went in. And I went in with the roots and stuff and blah, 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 my boots and the way I roll. And in both shows, both 90210 and ER, I would have to maintain my roots at some point in time over the course of my doing those shows. And they would, so I'd show up one day with perfectly blonde hair and no roots, and they would take mascara and root me right back up again. Put the, you know, like a marker and put fake black roots back in my hair.
That's your thing.
Those roots got me a lot of work.
That's I've never heard that before. That's great. So they sort of shift the character. But the character was on 90210. Emily Valentine was always meant to show up to throw everyone sort of a curveball and be sort of a different alternative kind of personality. And that's exactly what you ended up being. I mean, the description you gave of the original thoughts for the character doesn't really sound like that, strangely enough. It sounds more like someone who would have fit right in with right into the culture of West Beverly High, whereas you showed up and you just looked like, no offense, but purposely so, an outcast. You looked totally different than all the others, and that's... It would seem like that would have been the better way to go all along anyway.
Well, that's where Aaron Spelling deserves a little credit for having a little bit more, you know, his eye on the ball more than people maybe sometimes give him credit for. He's a very hands-on guy. You know, he was involved with everything, so nothing slipped by Aaron.
Was he a hands-on guy as far as bringing you onto the show? Was he?
Well, I had to audition for him, so yes. I mean, literally in his office, I had to audition for him.
Wow.
Everybody who read for that role did.
It was scary.
But Aaron, he's very sweet. He's a very sweet man. Like I said, he's known for sort of corny TV, you know, but, but I think he had he's more on the ball than maybe the corny TV would indicate.
Mm. Mm. And, well, I don't know where 90210 falls in that realm of corny TV. I'd probably put
pretty
it
corny.
In.
Pretty
yeah,
corny.
Yeah, yeah. But how, I mean...
Especially in retrospect. It's so quaint in retrospect. You know, because
yeah.
my character, as bad as she was with the drugs and the motorcycle and everything, they were very sort of ambiguous about whether Brandon and she were having sex or the sex was, you know, how taboo sex was and what's her, Donna Martin having her virginity until she was 75 years old. And and now shows about teenagers, I must be just officially an old lady because I am genuinely shocked at what they have teenagers doing on primetime television. Like, is this what kids really do? Are kids like just like out in nightclubs and doing hard drugs and having threesomes everywhere? Like, who behaves like that? Is that what kids do nowadays?
I don't know.
Calling me shocked.
I haven't seen any of it, but
you like Gossip Girl, all those shows, the new 90210, all the, you know, the shows that depict teenagers now. First of all, everybody's a supermodel. Everybody just walked out of a Victoria's Secret catalog. When does they start making teenage girls so friggin' beautiful? You know,
let me ask you a
question. Baby fat or awkwardness or anything.
I don't know. Let me ask you your opinion on something, though, that just popped into my head.
All right.
Donna Martin, Tori Spelling.
Yeah.
Long time innocent. The icon of innocence of that show. Do you think?
Yeah, because her dad's the producer of it. He's
exactly
not going to have his daughter doing gross things.
That was the deal? You think he was keeping that
character?
Yeah.
Would you want your daughter, like, you know, having threesomes? No.
Well, I wouldn't make a leap from virginity to having threesomes. There's probably
right.
some middle ground there that she may have hit David Silver or whatever. I don't really remember specifics, but I think that was well beyond your time. I think it was probably well into college that she finally relented, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, with the boyfriend she'd been with for a million years. Yeah. You know, the fact is there are girls like that. There are girls like that. That Donna Martin does represent a certain segment of the high school community. Not every high school girl is, you know, engaging. And, you know.
Oh,
hilarious
engaging as a verb. I'm sorry. I thought you were switching.
Yeah, you're engaging in activities of that nature is
okay.
what I meant. So the thing that's sort of false about it is that there's this community of kids that are all so different are all best friends. It used to always crack me up because everyone's sort of iconic. Everyone represents a certain segment, like Gilligan's Island. Everyone represents some sort of somebody from the social world, and they're, you know, they each represent their own big chunk of humanity, and all of us are meant to identify with the one that represents us. I lost my train of thought here on this one, but
the characters
not every
hanging
girl
out together.
Oh, I know. Hey, yeah. And so what always cracked me up on that show was when they got into the period with like the Peach Pit after dark, and they would have musicians on the show. They'd have like Boys to Men or who knows, the Cramps they had on, like a boy band and then a punk rock band. They had Power Man 5000 on there, and they'd have Kathy Dennis or something. And everybody on the show, every character on the show was a huge fan of all of them.
Yeah.
Everybody loves Boys to Men. Everyone loves the Cramps. Everyone's at the Peach Pit dancing. And that's hilarious. That is not how it works.
And it was,
so,
well, reality being it was whichever record company ponied up the most money to have their band featured in that episode.
Right. And then the band's not going to tolerate having any character on the show say, that band sucks. So everybody had to be a huge fan, which is ridiculously false. But it cracks me up every time.
That was when they became sort of a sellout show. When you were on the show, that's when it was, you know, real and gritty and, you know, basically
gritty's
a documentary
overseas, but yeah.
in real life.
Yeah. Yes, like The Hills. It was just that gritty.
Exactly. So you show up and your character has all this impact. I mean, you pretty much turned Beverly Hills upside down. And, I mean, there was fires and there was drugs and there was sex and there was rock and roll. All thanks to you, all thanks to Emily Valentine. Was there any sort of talk or any sort of potential plan to make your character more of a long-term addition to the show?
Well, funny you should ask. There was a great deal of talk at the end of that second season, my first season there. Mm-hmm. I had called Aaron Spelling directly, and this is why Aaron will always be a saint for me. I objected to it. I was heartbroken when they had my character do the stuff she was doing with the euphoria, et cetera, and the stalking and the, you know, losing her mind business, in love with Brandon stuff. Mm-hmm. I was disappointed by that because I had felt initially the theme that my character was bringing to the show was you can't judge a book by its cover. Everyone thought she was a slut. Everyone thought she was a drug addict. Turns out she's a virgin and she's a goody two shoes. And oh, now it turns out, look, she is bad. So, which everybody in that show who was blue collar had to go crazy at some point in time. But, it's just a rule in Beverly Hills. But I was disappointed that they were making that it came back around to, oh, you can judge a book by its cover. If she looks different from you, then she's going to, you know, snap at some point and you'll be sorry you ever knew her. And so Jason Priestley at the time was like, well, you should tell Aaron. You should tell Aaron you don't like it. I'm like, yeah, I'm going to call Aaron Spelling. That's going to happen. He's like, no, I'll do it right now. I'll dial my phone right now and put you in touch with him, which he then did. And I, like, so green and so, like, just oblivious to life, take the phone from him and ask for Aaron Spelling. Aaron Spelling, saint that he is, was, took my call, fielded my complaints about the direction my character was going in, which is ridiculous. He should have told them to fire me. And he said, don't worry, we're going to redeem your character. She'll be redeemed. And I go, yeah, well, okay. He's like, we're going to give you a spinoff. And I was like, oh, what? He's like, yeah, we'll give you a spinoff. I'm like, really? He's like, have I ever lied to you? What?
I said, news to you. Just
yeah, I go, he's like, have I ever lied to you? I go, well, I never talked to you before. You never really had an opportunity to, but I guess the answer is still no. He's like, yeah, so just go to work and have a good time, and don't worry about it. And so, like, a month or two went by, or three, and they actually did. They came to me to talk about this new show they were going to do, and they were going to use my character to spin off to make it, and that show was Melrose Place.
Uh-huh.
And I was in the initial discussions about that, and at the very, very end of season two, and negotiations didn't work out. I didn't like the terms they were offering me, and they said, fine, we'll just create a new character and spin that character off, and they created that Grant Show character, and they spun him off instead. So, yeah, that was meant to happen and didn't.
Huh. That's very interesting. So his, and I remember that well, his character was Jake. He was the leather jacket wearing bad guy or you know,
yeah,
bad boy guy.
He was
suddenly
a Fonzie. He was a Fonzie of Nanner 2-0, and I was the Pinky Tuscadero.
Yes. Wow, that's a great comparison. And he came out of nowhere, and I remember suddenly he was on 90210, like working on Kelly's house or something like that.
Yeah.
That's how they introduced
yeah.
him. He was just, and he was hooking up with her, of course. And,
yeah.
And then, like, a week later, Melrose was on, and it's, oh, it's a spinoff.
Yeah, of a character that nobody even really knows, but yeah.
Interesting. So
yeah.
Do you look back at that now and, you know, wonder what would have happened if things went differently?
I know exactly what would have happened. I know I'd be a lot richer. I would have spent a lot of time on a show that I didn't like.
Mm-hmm.
I have never watched that show. It's just not my style of television. I still had my aspirations in the film world. I still was holding out for that.
And the thing with Melrose Place is the original vision of that show when it first started, it was just sort of this maybe slightly grittier look at, you know, life as an adult as opposed to being in high school, you know,
right.
Post-school, post-college and all that stuff, people trying to work for a living and all that. And that's what it started as. And what it became was something very, very different. It became just an entirely sexual soap opera for the entire
right.
hour each week. So how, I mean, looking back at that, imagining yourself being one of those tenants and going through that, would you have...
I would have been in hell all the way to the bank. And I don't have any regrets about it. You know, at the time I was also living with Jason, and that would have tied my career on that show to his career on 90210 forever. It would have been just, and everyone would have thought the only reason I ever had a job was because of who my boyfriend was, which was something I was really wary of, a trap I was wary of falling into. So, you know, I don't regret it at all. Sure, the money would be nice, but I don't regret not doing the job. Mm. And Aaron Spelling didn't hold it against me. I worked for Aaron a lot after that. So yeah, money's always nice, but, you know.
Yeah. Hey. Yeah. If you have no regrets, then certainly things worked out the right way.
Yeah. Yeah.
All good. And you, so, you know, you had your stint in season two of 90210. I believe, did that stint end with you going off to the mental institution or something
to
that effect?
It did.
Okay. And that,
where
at
I got
that
Prozac
point,
and stabilized.
Yeah. And finally, West Beverly High was safe again.
Yes, until I came back.
Yeah, well, you came back, what, a couple years later? Or
I did. And that was the year that Kelly got burned in the fire. And oh, no, I didn't. That was the next time. I came back twice, like in season four and five, I guess.
Okay.
It always cracked. When Brandon went to San Francisco and ran into me, and there I left to go off to the Jacques Cousteau Institute and become a marine biologist. And then the following year, I came back, and that was the year that, coincidentally, Kelly was burned in a fire, which I always thought was funny. They never tied that into me because of my fire threats from the previous season. So.
Right. Like as a suspect, you mean? Could have made
this is a weird coincidence that whenever there's a fire on 90210, Emily Valentine's in the episode.
And in the end, you did sort of, your character did get somewhat of a redemption because you came through all your, you know, mental problems and you came out with a better life. And you went off to the Jacques Cousteau Institute.
I did. I'm a marine biologist. It's fantastic.
Am I stupid if I ask if that even actually exists? The Jacques Cousteau Institute.
Does it? Let me look it up. I don't think it does.
Oh, it's like saying I want to be a cartoonist. I'm going to Mickey Mouse U. Like, I don't think, I don't know. It's, it,
well, 90210 also did a, doesn't seem like there's an institute. There is a Jacques Cousteau National Estuarine Research Reserve, but they also like to exile people to France. Didn't Brenda get exiled off to France, too?
Yeah, you might be right. And I think the parents might have gone also at some
point.
It's like
the dog that is, don't worry about Skippy. He's on a farm now. He's happy on a farm.
Oh, no. What are you telling me?
I don't know. You never saw Emily Valentine again. Nor the parents.
Well, actually, Brenda came back in the new 90210, to my recollection.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah, which was a great decision creatively for all.
I have no comments.
Did they call you about that?
No.
That would have been badass to bring Emily.
You know,
Valentine
funny you
back.
Say that. I pitched myself to them when they created a character. I guess it's sort of a badass character on that show too. And they were. It's funny because that actress is always complaining about being compared to my character, which I think is funny. But what's her name? Something Silver? The character
Sylvie
or the actress?
Sylvie or something?
No,
familiar.
At any rate, they're sort of troubled character. They introduced a mother character to her who was a drummer and inappropriate with their kid, like sharing joints with her and was all in like living in Laurel Canyon and all hippie, like not hippie, but like. Well, she actually was written sort of hippie. And I was like, this doesn't make any sense. Based on the age this person is, the sort of tastes and stuff they're giving this woman are for somebody 20 years her senior. You know, she's not 65. She's 45. Like, you know, she wouldn't be into Joplin and you know, Hendrix. She'd be into something, Nirvana or something.
Right,
and so,
okay.
And so I actually pitched them that, they bring the character that character be Emily Valentine, and that she'd be more of an Amy Winehouse type. That Emily Valentine had gone off and not gotten her shit together, and was now this sort of more Amy Winehouse type. And they didn't go for it. They're like, no, we're going to hire Kelly Lynch, who's actually really a drummer. So, and she's sweet too. So I have no problem with Kelly Lynch, but I did pitch that idea, and I got the finger.
See, that would have been cool. I mean, if you're going to continue a show for a long period of time or bring it back or whatever, at the very least, give some sort of relation to the old stuff for, you know, the trivia buffs and the geeks to really latch onto and get excited about. That would have been.
I'm totally with you on that, and it gives texture and depth to a show. It creates a deep history for the show to have that kind of thing happen. But whatever, it didn't happen.
Oh, they're canceled now. So, and why? No Emily Valentine.
Yep, you see? Just write them and tell them.
I don't think they care anymore.
They don't. They didn't care when I pitched the idea.
So let's fast forward to the future, or to the present, I should say, and let's talk about all the things you have going on now, because you are an eclectic person.
Thank you.
And you've spoken already about this Waterfront Film Festival, and you already mentioned what I was going to pick out, because I was looking at some of the information about this year's version, and the thing that stuck out at me was the Cool as Ice showing, and that was just the most random thing I've seen in a long time. Describe for us exactly what the deal is with this film festival. What is the overall theme?
There is no overall theme. It's a great festival. We screen, this year we screened like 90 movies, some of them short, some of them features, some of them documentaries, comedies, dramas, horror films, a little something for everybody, something for grandma, something for the kids, something for everybody, hopefully. The three flashback movies we screened because we did Child's. I program it. I'm already there. They chose Child's Play 2 because I could be there to support the screening of it. There's an actress named Kristen Minter with whom I did ER. She's the female lead in Cool as Ice. She had another film in the festival, so she was going to be there. So they go, hey, we'll do Cool as Ice and have Minter support that one. And we had E.G. Daly. She was our opening night music for the festival. She was already there, so we'll screen Pee-wee and have her, E.G., show up to do the support for that film. So it isn't as random as it seems on the surface. It was very practical. That's what it was.
Gotcha. So what kind of atmosphere is it for a showing of a movie like Cool as Ice? Are people wild getting into it, making noise, and lots of excitement?
I didn't go to that screening, frankly, because I'm a programmer and I've seen every single solitary movie that's in the program already, because I'm one of the people that helps choose which ones get in. Mm-hmm. I don't go to many screenings, if any, during the duration of the festival. Then I'm just going to parties and hanging out with filmmakers and doing other tasks that are part of making the festival work, doing panels, that kind of thing. I went to the Child's Play screening because I hadn't seen it for so long. I wanted to see the whole thing through. The Child's Play screening was, you know, her screening, Cool as Ice and Child's Play screened at 11 p.m., so that's late. It's late to do a screening. I think they're pretty well attended, though, considering. And people stayed for my Q&A. They stayed for probably half an hour of questions afterwards.
Cool.
I assume that she had a similar, that Cool as Ice and that Pee-wee had similar experiences, or, you know.
Gotcha. So you said there were about 90 movies in this festival, and how many?
Yeah.
How many do you have to go through to get down to that number?
This year, about 600.
How do you do it? What's the selection process?
You watch every single solitary movie.
and then you
score them. You score them based on lots of factors, and then basically you get in the pit, and that is some of the highest rated ones nobody's going to argue with. Everyone agrees they should be in. And then when you get toward the last, you know, dozen slots or so, there's a bit of skirmish about, you know, I like this one and I hate that one. And you make your case for the one you love, and you hope you can get some allies to support you. It's kind of like Survivor. You create secret alliances, and also sometimes the film doesn't get in because we have other ones that's wildly popular and too much like it, you know, so.
Right.
Or sometimes they're a little bit too intense for our crowd, or or maybe the running time is too long, which is kind of a weird technical problem, but our slots are written in stone, and so the movie's 2.5 hours long. That's how big the slot is. We literally can't fit you in the slot there is. So, all kinds of things. I program for like 3 other festivals during the course of the year, too, so I'm doing it all year long. So now half the work I have to do for Waterfront has been done earlier in the year by the work I've been doing for the other festivals. And so I sort of leapfrog my way through the year, always, always, always with homework waiting for me, which is always watching movies, always. There's never a time where I can sit down and go, I have nothing to do. I always have movies to watch.
Wow. And you still obviously love doing this. I mean, after all this time, it sounds like something either you have to truly love to be able to do it all, or else there's no way you can survive even getting through dealing with one festival. I mean, I could just imagine the feeling of wanting to jump off of a bridge just with, I mean, as great as a lot of these movies probably are, just the sheer
amount. A lot are awful.
Well, yeah.
A lot of them are terrible, so, yeah. I do love it. I love filmmaking. I love movies. It's why I moved to California. And it doesn't always have to be my movie. I love other people's movies.
Do you enjoy it on this side of things more so than being in front of the camera?
No, of course not. Of course not. I'd rather be doing something myself. But if I can't, in the interim, I will support other people doing what they do. It's a community, you know. I don't think it's a contest. I think it's a community, and I believe in. There's enough out there for all of us, you know. So I think everybody helping everybody is great, and watching other people's work is really inspiring. You see some great stuff, and you feel like, well, inspired is the short word. So it's a short.
Well, you're helping to sort of move the art in a vague sense forward just by bringing all this stuff to light and being someone who is part of the process of bringing all the best stuff to visibility. So is there a sense of power there, a sense of sort of maybe having a slight part in the destiny of films in general?
No, that's overstated. You know, the selection committee is, I mean, it's a group. So it's not like I'm a kingmaker and I'm sitting there with my, you know, scepter dubbing this film and that film and not this one. So no, it's not a sense of power at all, and a lot of the films, all they'll ever do is do a little run at a festival, you know, a couple of festivals, and that's it. So it isn't like they're going to go off to be Academy Award winning films. Some of them are, actually. Some it has happened, but you know, it's just nice to get to see a great movie and put asses in seats and have the filmmaker be happy and have an audience be happy. It's just, that's gratifying. It's like hosting an art show and having everybody love it, and the artist feels loved, and the crowd saw some beautiful art. It's like a gallery. It's like being a gallery owner, basically. It's like that.
Huh.
Not getting paid. There's no money involved. $0.
Really?
0 pennies I have earned, yes.
Is there
a pro bono gallery I'm running.
Wow. So it's just truly for the love. That's pretty admirable.
Mm-hmm.
You don't really run into, in the greater scheme of things, you don't run into a lot of people who do anything strictly for the love of anything.
I don't think that's true. I think that's true. That is so true in the creative world, whether you're a writer or an actor or a dancer or, you know, whatever you are. It is virtually impossible to make a living doing anything creative. And so, and especially nowadays, but with the music industry, what's happened to that, it's kind of happening to the acting world too, where there's just so much free content out there and so much reality television, which is just destroying original, you know, narrative television. I mean, just think how much more work there'd be for actors if there was no reality television and all those channels that needed content. And then every single actor in town would have a job, you know, instead of 1% of them. But I think that there's more than half of the jobs I've done in the last 10 years, I made $100 a day on them, which is only because the union insists that I get at least that much. Otherwise, it would have been for free. And if a movie's under a certain budget, it's for free. And I think you'd be surprised how much people do for free.
Hmm.
Musicians play out at bars all the time. That's for free. Sometimes they even pay to do it.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So it's how much do you get paid to do what you're doing?
That is true. That's a good point. Yeah, you're absolutely right. Let's talk about some of the other things that you are doing. Totally different note. www.delightfuldeliciousdelovely.com, a food porn blog.
Yes.
For those who don't know what that is, because I'll be honest, when I first saw that, before I looked at the site, I had a very different image of what I was about to see.
You were envisioning cucumbers and zucchinis and melons.
Put it this way. I was at work, and I chose to not use my work computer to look at it because I was worried about what was going to pop up on the screen. But how would you describe it?
Instead of porn, you saw lasagna or
something. Hey. Some people, that's just as exciting. So
that's hence my title for the site.
Yeah, so it's just very vivid photography, exciting-looking food. How else would you describe
it? Most of which I make, most of them are my recipes, so this is all my content. Like, I made the food. In most cases, I made up the recipe, and then I did all the photography, too, and I do all the writing on it. It's 100% me. Sometimes I go to a restaurant and I review that kind of thing, too. But the food you see, if it's not restaurant food, I made it.
And this is just another side of you, another labor of love. It's just you putting it out there and you wanting people to check it out? Or is there another aspect to the food porn business?
I enjoy cooking. It's a super zen thing for me. The blog allows me to do a couple of things I really enjoy, which one is writing, and two is photography. I have a photography site as well, and I like to cook and I like to eat. So it marries all those things for me, and it gives me an outlet, a creative outlet. The film festivals are another creative outlet, but a different kind, where it's not my input, it's something else. So it sort of rounds that whole experience out for me. I send it out there like it's like sending a message in a bottle. I have no idea who's seeing it. I get very little feedback on it until I go out in public. I went to my festival a couple weeks ago, and I got a lot of positive feedback and a lot of people telling me that they're making. I love that recipe. I made it for my boyfriend, and he was people apparently are looking at it and are trying the recipes, but so far they haven't felt inspired enough to tell me, on the day, write on the blog or write me on Facebook or something and tell me that they've done it. But every time I do go out and in a group of people, I hear a lot of feedback on it. So it is being viewed, at least. But I think, you know, as an artist nowadays, you have so much control or so much opportunity to get yourself out there that didn't used to exist. You know, MySpace was that, you know, mecca for musicians, and now everybody's in on it. Everybody has some, you know, way to self-promote. And I think that, you know, I've got a friend who's an actor who's got 120 followers on Twitter, 120,000, I'm sorry, followers on Twitter. And I know I wrote a novel based on a short film that I made a couple of years ago, and I'm trying to find a publisher for that novel. If I had 120,000 followers on Twitter, I would have a very easy time finding someone to publish my novel because they would see me as a monster self-promoter.
Right.
So I think that if you're in anything creative, these things all cross-pollinate and they all feed each other. And the expression of luck is when tenacity meets preparedness. So, you know, it's just if anything I do sticks, if the blog suddenly takes off and gets huge, or if I sell my book, or if I get a television show, you know, I'm a regular, all these things everything will blow up if one of them does, and everything, because everything's completely set up and ready to go. And so that's just me trying every end against the middle.
Yeah.
And staying busy.
I know, and it's funny because, you know, as corporate and as sort of commercial and sellout as this might sound, pretty much in today's day and age, everyone is basically a brand, and everything that you do is sort of, it's synergy, and it all, you know, it all, like you said, plays into each other, and it just becomes part of that overall identity. And you'd mentioned a short film. Is it the one that we were looking at the other day,
Bathing in the Single Girl?
Yes. Is that the
Bathing
what you're looking
Single Girl,
to?
Yeah.
that's something
that's
that
short.
Go on.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, I was going to say it's something that a lot of eyes have seen. A lot of it's been to many festivals, according to the website. 103 festivals. This thing is has been played
yeah.
at.
Yeah, I worked that thing to death.
Yeah, that's amazing, and I got to watch it, and I had absolutely no idea what to expect. I, you know, gotten the link. Let's see what it is, and it's really entertaining stuff. And it's you. It's all you. And what was the inspiration for that? Where did that come from? And what's the general idea behind it for those who aren't familiar?
It was born of, I used to go to this comedy, the theater here in Hollywood called the UCB Upright Citizens Brigade Theater in Hollywood, right near where I live. And a couple of years ago, they would do a series called Four Stories and a Cover, and they would have four different people read like a 2,000-word true life comic essay about themselves. And then four people would do that, and then someone would do a goofy cover of a song. I used to attend it all the time, and it was hilarious. And my friend of mine who's a writer was like, you know, we should both do that. I'll do it if you do it. If you write a story and do it, I'll do the same thing. So I did it. She never did. She bailed, never did it again. But I did it, and the story I wrote was what you saw in that movie. So that was written to be read off paper to a live audience, which is why I address the audience so much and why it's so not necessarily conversational. It feels a little presentational because that's what it was written for. And then I was like, well, damn, I should have videotaped that because my agent doesn't think I'm funny, and like I have no proof that I'm funny because I haven't done any comedy stuff, high profile comedy stuff. And so I was like, I should just do it again at a different comedy theater and have somebody videotape it so I can show my agent, or she can show a casting director that, you know, here's Christine being funny. And so I did that, and I posted that on Facebook, and a friend of mine who's a DP, is a big A-list commercial DP, does, like, you know, Oil of Olay and hair dye commercials. Like, he's the go-to guy if you want women to look beautiful in your commercial. And he'd been a friend. He was my team leader in a volunteer group I was trying to get Obama elected the first time. And he saw that video and was like, oh, that the piece is hilarious, but it just looks like ass. It's so ugly. There's no, you're on the stage. It's not lit. You know, it's awful. If you let me direct this short for you, I'll shoot it for you for free. I'm like, well, okay, yes, yes, the man who makes women look beautiful for a living, you are totally welcome to come photograph me in my house while I do this material. And so he's not a director, though, he's a DP. And we did it, we recorded the whole thing just in one place, actually, one position, basically. And it's 10 minutes long, and it's a 10-minute-long monologue, and with no cutting away to things, it was just too... It was boring, frankly. It looked beautiful, but it was boring. And so we set some more stuff into it, and then we started to have disagreements about what stuff I wanted him to shoot certain other things, and he wouldn't, or he'd shoot it, but he wouldn't edit it in for me. And he got frustrated with me. He was like, you guys have this footage. I don't want it. Just take it. I don't care. Do with it what you will. So I brought another friend in to shoot another 3 days of material, and he cut it together for me. And that's it. I didn't change a word of it from what had been written to be read out loud to what is shot in that short. And it's 10 minutes of me telling awkward and embarrassing stories about trying to have sex. And it's a short comedy shorts. All festivals like a short comedy. They just do. They just fit. They tend to do well. Hey, everybody out there, if you're a filmmaker, make a short comedy. They're easy to get programmed. And so I did, and then I already knew a little bit about film festivals because I've been doing my own for 12 or 13 years at that point in time. And I started submitting it, and I started getting asked to come to festivals and be a juror. I was a juror at a festival in Alabama called Sidewalk and one in Tennessee called Indy Memphis. And I started getting involved in the broader regional film festival circuit. And so once my film ran its course over the course of 2 years, I still now juroring for or curating for or otherwise doing panels or working for a whole bunch of these festivals. And so I'm like neck deep in festivals, and that's that. The DVD of that short is available. I think there's a link on the site bathingandthesinglegirl.com, I think it's $20 for the DVD.
Cool.
And so, yeah.
Yeah, it's another side of you, another side of Christine. And let's
aren't I just fascinating? You just can't tie me down.
You can't figure this girl out. She is crazy.
Nope. Next thing you think she's a cook, next thing you know she's making a movie, next thing you know she's a juror on a film festival.
Unbelievable. You've got to be one of the busiest people that I've interviewed thus far. I mean, I have to imagine just the film festival itself is at least a full-time job, and then trying to get everything else in that you do, I mean...
And I wrote a novel. And I wrote a 400-page novel based on that short I'm trying to sell.
That's amazing.
So, yeah.
And hopefully that comes to fruition, because I think that's an extension of that 10-minute piece would be an amazing book, I think.
Let me promise you, it will be the funniest book you ever read in your life. It is so much better than that movie. My book is the funniest thing ever written, I promise you.
Wow.
I hold my own with it's a savage, savage, hilarious, cruel telling of what it's like to be a girl in this town. And have really, really uncomfortable, awkward, embarrassing sex.
What?
It's a crowd pleaser.
Sort of like a comedic version of what's the weird porn book that was huge like 2 years ago?
Oh right, yeah, 50 Shades of Grey.
Yeah.
Yeah, from your lips to God's ears. That woman had 4 of the top 5 best-selling books on the best-selling books of 2012 list.
Oh, my God.
She had number 1, 2, 3, and 5. 50 Shades of Grey 1, 50 Shades of Grey 2, 50 Shades of Grey 3, and then number 5 was the box set having all 3 of them in it. She had 4 of the top. That woman's an overnight millionaire, billionaire.
And I can't imagine that it's that much different than any of these other thousands of books out there with some muscled-up dude, Fabio or something, with his shirt off.
Right.
Any other romance novel, but...
I haven't read any of them, but I think that 50 Shades of Grey might be just a bit more graphic and a bit more unapologetically porn. Erotica, pardon me, erotica.
Yes.
Mine is not erotica. Mine is like, mine would be like, oh God, I'm referencing the voice again, I'm such a dork. But mine would be like Michelle Samuel, you know, experiencing 50 Shades of Grey, like, you know, the geek with the glasses and, you know, the outcast. Having just
a more horrible
lucky bed.
I said a more relatable, perhaps, 50 Shades of Grey.
Yeah. If you want to treat yourself to 3 minutes of hilarity, on YouTube, look up Gilbert Gottfried reading from 50 Shades of Grey. It's pretty funny.
I've got a feeling that leads to a lot of bad dreams for a long period of time.
Yeah, how could it not?
Yikes. Okay, well, let's talk once again. Let's just go over everything you have going on so people know how to follow you, how to enjoy everything that you're putting out, so to speak. Bathingandthesinglegirl.com is your information source for everything having to do with this 10-minute masterpiece of a comedic film. That's won so many awards and so many festivals, and you can get the DVD from that website. You can read about the information about it. And what else is on the website? Anything? Let's see here.
My Facebook page is my real name, just Christina Lise McCarthy with my last name McCarthy. That's who I am on Facebook.
Okay.
I'm on Twitter. It's with C. Elise McCarthy.
Are you active on these things? Are you?
I am. I'm super active on Facebook. Twitter. Yeah, yeah. I am interactive. Yes, I am. I'm fully interactive.
Fully interactive.
Just like a video game. And the cooking site is delightful, delicious, lovely, .com or dddblog.com. Delightful, delicious, lovely. And follow the blog on the blog, please. Don't follow it on Facebook. Follow it on the blog. And then you'll get an email every time I post something. And it's not just recipes. I tell embarrassing stories there, too, like about going to the gynecologist and other charming events from my life. So you get to know way too much about me if you follow the blog, more than you ever wanted to know.
Awesome.
Inside and out, so to speak.
Wow. A lot of big boasts, a lot of big promises in the last few minutes of this interview. People are really getting excited about checking out all this stuff, I have to believe. Maybe a bit too excited. Calm down, guys. But we have left off one other thing. You mentioned your film festivals that you deal with year in, year out. The major one, waterfrontfilm.org. That's where you can find out what is going down. At what point is new information going to start popping up for next year's event?
Probably not until after January, since it just happened. We have the chips, I mean, the dust hasn't even settled from this one. But I work for three others. I'm a programmer for three others. One is here in Beverly Hills called Lady Filmmakers. I think their site is ladyfilmmakers.com or .org. I'm not sure, but Lady Filmmakers. I do two in Texas, both in March usually. One is called Self-Medicated Film Festival, or RxSM, like a prescription, RxSM.org, and one called the Victoria, Texas Independent Film Festival, which is VTXIFF.com.
Okay.
So there.
Yeah, check them all out, all different parts of the country. Wherever you are, travel out to any of these whenever you can, certainly, you've got
support.
The trademark programming of Christine behind all of that, that influence.
Yes.
So good stuff definitely coming along. Anything else you want to promote?
No, that's that. I think I chewed your ear off properly.
No, you've got plenty going on. I'd imagine if you had anything else, you wouldn't be sleeping anymore, which I can't even imagine you're sleeping very much right now.
I do just fine. I have three dogs to nurse me, to lull me to sleep, and
that sounds
snore and fart in my face.
On that note, wow. Thank you for cold showering all those freaks out there.
there you go. And there's that.
Yes.
Dog all farts. Right. Thank you. Good night.
Well, Christine, thank you so much. This has been highly informative, awesome insight. And it's awesome to hear that you're doing so many cool things to this day and beyond that people can check out. And thank you for devoting as much time as you did to be on the show. We appreciate it.
No problem. No, thank you for having me.
Cool. So, guys, thank you for joining us here at Down with the 90s. Until next week, I'm Jerry Strauss, and we'll see you then. Okay. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Did I keep you too long?
What? No. It was fun.
Oh, okay.
That was fun.
Cool. All right. Well, I'm not 100% sure when this will go up. It will be at the earliest next week. It might be the week after.
Okay.
Not up to me. But as soon as I find out and it goes up and I get a link, I will let you know when and where it is and give you the info.
Awesome. Thank you.
Yeah, no problem. All right. Thanks a lot.
Okay. You got it. Have a great night.